split fresh timber, as the woodshop boys made sets and stage scenery. Only the graduates were left out of the general bustle. We were free to sit in the library at the back of the building, or look in quite detachedly, naturally, on the measures being taken for our event. Even the minister preached on graduation the Sunday before. His subject was, "Let your light so shine that men will see your good works and praise your Father who is in heaven." Although the sermon was purported to be addressed to us, he used the occasion to speak to backsliders, gamblers, and general ne'er-do-wells. But since he had called our names at the beginning of the service, we were mollified. Among Negroes, the tradition was to give presents to children going only from one grade to another. How much more important this was when the person was graduating at the top of the class. Uncle Willie and Mama had sent away for a Mickey Mouse watch like Bailey's. Louise gave me 4 embroidered handkerchiefs. I gave her 3 crocheted doilies. Mrs. Sneed, the minister's wife, made me an underskirt to wear for graduation, and nearly every customer gave me a nickel or maybe even a dime with the instruction, "Keep on moving to higher ground," or some such encouragement. Amazingly, the great day finally dawned, and I was out of bed before I knew it. I threw open the back door to see it more clearly, but Mama said, "Sister, come away from that door and put your robe on." I hoped the memory of that morning would never leave me. Sunlight was itself still young, and the day had none of the insistence maturity would bring it in a few hours. In my robe and barefoot in the backyard, under cover of going to see about my new beans, I gave myself up to the gentle warmth and thanked God that no matter what evil I had done in my life, He had allowed me to live to see this day. Somewhere in my fatalism, I had expected to die accidentally and never have the chance to walk up the stairs in the auditorium and gracefully receive my hard-earned diploma. Out of God's merciful bosom, I had one reprieve. Bailey came out in his robe and gave me a box wrapped in Christmas paper. He said he had saved his money for months to pay for it. It felt like a box of chocolates, but I knew Bailey wouldn't save money to buy candy when we had all we could want under our noses. He was as proud of the gift as I. It was a soft, leather-bound copy of a collection of poems by Edgar Allan Poe, or as Bailey and I called him, Eep. I turned to Annabel Lee, and we walked up and down the garden rows, the cool dirt between our toes, reciting the beautifully sad line. Mama made a Sunday breakfast, although it was only Friday. After we finished the blessing, I opened my eyes to find the watch on my plate. It was a dream of a day. Everything went smoothly, and to my credit, I didn't have to be reminded or scolded for anything. Near evening, I was too jittery to attend to chores, so Bailey volunteered to do all before his bath. Days before, we had made a sign for the store, and as we turned out the lights, Mama hung the cardboard over the doorknob. It read clearly, "Closed, graduation." My dress fitted perfectly, and everyone said I looked like a sunbeam in it. On the hill, going toward the school, Bailey walked behind with Uncle Willie, who muttered, "Go on, Jew." He wanted him to walk ahead with us because it embarrassed him to have to walk so slowly. Bailey said he'd let the ladies walk together and the men would bring up the rear. We all laughed nicely. Little children dashed by out of the dark like fireflies, their crepe paper dresses and butterfly wings were not made for running, and we heard more than one rip dryly, and the regretful "oh-oh" that followed. The school blazed without gaiety. The windows seemed cold and unfriendly from the lower hill. A sense of ill-fated timing crept over me, and if Mama hadn't reached for my hand, I would have drifted back to Bailey and Uncle Willie and possibly beyond. She made a few slow jokes about my feet getting cold and tugged me along to the now strange building. Around the front steps, assurance came back. There were my fellow greats, the graduating class, hair brushed back, legs oiled, new dresses, and pressed pleats, fresh pocket handkerchiefs, and little handbags, all home sewn. Oh, we were up to snuff, all right. I joined my comrades and didn't even see my family go in to find seats in the crowded auditorium. The school band struck up a march, and all classes filed in as had been rehearsed. We stood in front of our seats as a sign, and on a signal from the choir director, we sat. No sooner had this been accomplished than the band started to play the national anthem. We rose again and sang the song, after which we recited the Pledge of Allegiance. We remained standing for a brief minute before the choir director and the principal signaled to us, rather desperately, I thought, to take our seats. The command was so unusual that our carefully rehearsed and smooth-running machine was thrown off. For a full minute, we fumbled for our chairs and bumped into each other awkwardly. Habits change or solidify under pressure, so in our state of nervous tension, we had been ready to follow our usual assembly pattern, the American National Anthem, then the Pledge of Allegiance, then the song every black person I knew called the Negro National Anthem, all done in the same key, with the same passion, and most often standing on the same foot. Finding my seat at last, I was overcome with a presentiment of worse things to come. Something unrehearsed, unplanned was going to happen, and we were going to be made to look bad. I distinctly remember being explicit in the choice of pronoun. It was we, the graduating class, the unit, that concerned me then. The principal welcomed parents and friends and asked the Baptist minister to lead us in prayer. His invocation was brief and punchy, and for a second I thought we were getting back on the high road to right action. When the principal came back to the dais, however, his voice had changed. Sounds always affected me profoundly, and the principal's voice was one of my favorites. During assembly, it melted and lowed weakly into the audience. It had not been in my plan to listen to him, but my curiosity was piqued, and I straightened up to give him my attention. He was talking about Booker T. Washington, our late great leader, who said we can be as close as the fingers on the hand, etc. Then he said a few vague things about friendship and the friendship of kindly people to those less fortunate than themselves. With that, his voice nearly faded thin away, like a river diminishing to a stream and then to a trickle. But he cleared his throat and said, "Our speaker tonight, who is also our friend, came from Texarkana to deliver the commencement address. But due to the irregularity of the train schedule, he's going to, as they say, speak and run." He said that we understood and wanted the man to know that we were most grateful for the time he was able to give us. And then something about how we were willing always to adjust to another's program. And without more ado, I give you Mr. Edward Donlevy. Not one but two white men came through the door off stage. The shorter one walked to the speaker's platform. and the tall one moved over to the center seat and sat down. But that was our principal seat and already occupied. The dislodged gentleman bounced around for a long breath or two before the Baptist minister gave him his chair. Then, with more dignity than the situation deserved, the minister walked off the stage. Don Levy looked at the audience once. On reflection, I'm sure that he wanted only to reassure himself that we were really there. Adjusted his glasses and began to read from a sheaf of papers. He was glad to be here and to see the work going on just as it was in the other schools. At the first amen from the audience, I willed the offender to immediate death by choking on the word. But amens and yes sirs began to fall around the room like rain through a ragged umbrella. He told us of the wonderful changes we children in Stamps had in store. The central school, naturally the white school was central, had already been granted improvements that would be in use in the fall. A well-known artist was coming from Little Rock to teach art to them. They were going to have the newest microscopes and chemistry equipment for their laboratory. Mr. Don Levy didn't leave us long in the dark over who made these improvements available to Central High. Nor were we to be ignored in the general betterment scheme he had in mind. He said he had pointed out to people at a very high level that one of the first line football tacklers at Arkansas Agricultural and Mechanical College had graduated from good old Lafayette County Training School. Here, fewer amens were heard. Those few that did break through lay dully in the air with the heaviness of habit. He went on to praise us. He went on to say how he had bragged that one of the best basketball players at Fisk sank his first ball right here at Lafayette County Training School. The white kids were going to have a chance to become Galileos and Madame Curies and Edisons and Gauguins. And our boys, the girls weren't even in on it, would try to be Jesse Owenses and Joe Louises. Owens and the Brown Bomber were great heroes in our world. But what school official in the white goddom of Little Rock had the right to decide that those two men must be our only heroes? Who decided that for Henry Reed to become a scientist, he had to work like George Washington Carver as a bootblack to buy a lousy microscope? Bailey was obviously always going to be too small to be an athlete. So which concrete angel glued to what country seat had decided that if my brother wanted to become a lawyer, he had to first pay penance for his skin by picking cotton and hoeing corn, and studying correspondence books at night for 20 years. The man's dead words fell like bricks around the auditorium, and too many settled in my belly. Constrained by hard-learned manners, I couldn't look behind me, but to my left and right, the proud graduating class of 1940 had dropped their heads. Every girl in my row had found something new to do with her handkerchief. Some folded the tiny squares into love knots, some into triangles, but most were wadding them, then pressing them flat on their yellow laps. On the dais, the ancient tragedy was being replayed. Professor Parsons sat, a sculptor's reject, rigid. His large, heavy body seemed devoid of will or willingness, and his eyes said he was no longer with us. The other teachers examined the flag, which was draped stage right, or their notes, or the windows which opened on our now famous playing diamond. Graduation, the hush-hush magic time of frills and gifts and congratulations and diplomas, was finished for me before my name was called. The accomplishment was nothing. The meticulous maps drawn in three colors of ink, learning and spelling decasyllabic words, memorizing the whole of The Rape of Lucrece. It was for nothing. Don Levy had exposed us. We were maids and farmers, handymen and washerwomen, and anything higher that we aspired to was farcical and presumptuous. Then I wished that Gabriel Prosser and Nat Turner had killed all white folks in their beds, and that Abraham Lincoln had been assassinated before the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, and that Harriet Tubman had been killed by that blow on her head, and that Christopher Columbus had drowned in the Santa Maria. It was awful to be Negro and have no control over my life. It was brutal to be young and already trained to sit quietly and listen to charges brought against my color with no chance of defense. We should all be dead. I thought I should like to see us all dead, one on top of the other, a pyramid of flesh, with the white folks on the bottom as the broad base, then the Indians with their silly tomahawks and teepees and wigwams and treaties, the Negroes with their mops and recipes and cotton sacks and spirituals sticking out of their mouths. The Dutch children should all stumble in their wooden shoes and break their necks. The French should choke to death on the Louisiana Purchase, 1803, while silkworms ate all the Chinese with their stupid pigtails. As a species, we were an abomination, all of us. Don Levy was running for election and assured our parents that if he won, we could count on having the only colored paved playing field in that part of Arkansas. Also, he never looked up to acknowledge the grunts of acceptance. Also, we were bound to get some new equipment for the home economics building and the workshop. He finished, and since there was no need to give any more than the most perfunctory thank yous, he nodded to the men on the stage, and the tall white man, who was never introduced, joined him at the door. They left with the attitude that now they were off to something really important. The graduation ceremonies at Lafayette County Training School had been a mere preliminary. The ugliness they left was palpable, an uninvited guest who wouldn't leave. The choir was summoned and sang a modern arrangement of Onward Christian Soldiers, with new words pertaining to graduates seeking their place in the world. But it didn't work. Eloise, the daughter of the Baptist minister, recited Invictus, and I could have cried at the impertinence of, "I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul." My name had lost its ring of familiarity, and I had to be nudged to go and receive my diploma. All my preparations had fled. I neither marched up to the stage like a conquering Amazon, nor did I look in the audience for Bailey's nod of approval. Marguerite Johnson, I heard the name again. My honors were read. There were noises in the audience of appreciation, and I took my place on the stage as rehearsed. I thought about colors I hated, ecru, puce, lavender, beige, and black. There was shuffling and rustling around me. Then Henry Reed was giving his valedictory address. To be or not to be? Hadn't he heard the white folks? We couldn't be, so the question was a waste of time. Henry's voice came out clear and strong. I feared to look at him. Hadn't he got the message? There was no nobler in the mind for Negroes, because the world didn't think we had minds. And they let us know it. Outrageous fortune? Now that was a joke. When the ceremony was over, I had to tell Henry Reed some things. That is, if I still cared. Not rub Henry, erase. Ah, there's the erase, us. Henry had been a good student in elocution. His voice rose on tides of promise and fell on waves of warnings. The English teacher had helped him to create a sermon winging through Hamlet's soliloquy. To be a man, a doer, a builder, a leader, or to be a tool, an unfunny joke, a crusher of funky toadstools. I marvel that Henry could go through with the speech as if we had a choice. I had been listening and silently rebutting each sentence with my eyes closed. Then there was a hush, which in any audience warns that something unplanned is happening. I looked up and saw Henry Reed, the conservative, the proper, the A student, turn his back to the audience and turn to us, the proud graduating class of 1940, and sing, nearly speaking, "Lift every voice and sing, till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty." It was a poem written by James Weldon Johnson. It was the music composed by J. Rosamond Johnson. It was the Negro National Anthem. Out of habit, we were singing it. Our mothers and fathers stood in the dark hall and joined the hymn of encouragement. A kindergarten teacher led the small children onto the stage, and the buttercups and daisies and bunny rabbits marked time and tried to follow. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rod, felt in the days when hope unborn had died. Yet with a steady beat, have not our weary feet come to the place for which our fathers sighed. Every child I knew had learned that song with his ABCs, and along with Jesus Loves Me, This I Know. But I personally had never heard it before. Never heard the words, despite the thousands of times I had sung them. Never thought they had anything to do with me. On the other hand, the words of Patrick Henry had made such an impression on me that I had been able to stretch myself tall and trembling and say, "I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." And now I heard, really for the first time, "We have come over a way that with tears has been watered. We have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughtered." While echoes of the song shivered in the air, Henry Reed bowed his head and said thank you and returned to his place in line. The tears that slipped down many faces were not wiped away in shame. We were on top again, as always, again. We survived. The depths had been icy and dark, but now a bright sun spoke to our souls. I was no longer simply a member of the proud graduating class of 1940. I was a proud member of the wonderful, beautiful Negro race. Oh, Black known and unknown poets, how often have your auctioned pain sustained us? Who will compute the lonely nights made less lonely by your songs, or by the empty pots made less tragic by your tales? If we were a people much given to revealing secrets, we might raise monuments and sacrifice to the memories of our poets. But slavery cured us of that weakness. It may be enough, however, to have it said that we survive in exact relationship to the dedication of our poets, include preachers, musicians, and blues singers. 24. The angel of the candy counter had found me out at last, and was exacting excruciating penance for all the stolen Milky Ways, Mounds, Mr. Goodbars, and Hershey's with almonds. I had two cavities that were rotten to the gums. The pain was beyond the bailiwick of crushed aspirin or oil of cloves. Only one thing could help me, so I prayed earnestly that I'd be allowed to sit under the house and have the building collapse on my left jaw. Since there was no Negro dentist in Stamps, nor doctor either for that matter, Mama had dealt with previous toothaches by pulling them out, a string tied to the tooth with the other end looped over her fist, painkillers, and prayer. In this particular instance, the medicine had proved ineffective. There wasn't enough enamel left to hook a string on, and the prayers were being ignored because the balancing angel was blocking their passage. I lived a few days and nights in blinding pain, not so much toying with as seriously considering the idea of jumping in the well, and Mama decided I had to be taken to a dentist. The nearest Negro dentist was in Texarkana, 25 miles away, and I was certain that I'd be dead long before we reached half the distance. Mama said we'd go to Dr. Lincoln, right in Stamps, and he'd take care of me. She said he owed her a favor. I knew that there were a number of white folks in town that owed her favors. Bailey and I had seen the books, which showed how she had lent money to blacks and whites alike during the Depression, and most still owed her. But I couldn't aptly remember seeing Dr. Lincoln's name, nor had I ever heard of a Negro's going to him as a patient. However, Mama said we were going and put water on the stove for our baths. I had never been to a doctor, so she told me that after the bath, which would make my mouth feel better, I had to put on freshly starched and ironed underclothes from inside out. The ache failed to respond to the bath, and I knew then that the pain was more serious than that which anyone had ever suffered. Before we left the store, she ordered me to brush my teeth and then wash my mouth with Listerine. The idea of even opening my clamped jaws increased the pain. But upon her explanation that when you go to a doctor, you have to clean yourself all over, but most especially the part that's to be examined, I screwed up my courage and unlocked my teeth. The cool air in my mouth and the jarring of my molars dislodged what little remained of my reason. I had frozen to the pain. My family nearly had to tie me down to take the toothbrush away. It was no small effort to get me started on the road to the dentist. Mama spoke to all the passers-by, but didn't stop to chat. She explained over her shoulder that we were going to the doctor, and she'd pass the time of day on our way home. Until we reached the pond, the pain was my world, an aura that haloed me for 3 feet around. Crossing the bridge into white folks' country, pieces of sanity pushed themselves forward. I had to stop moaning and start walking straight. The white towel, which was drawn under my chin and tied over my head, had to be arranged. If one was dying, it had to be done in style if the dying took place in white folks' part of town. On the other side of the bridge, the ache seemed to lessen as if a white breeze blew off the white folks and cushioned everything in their neighborhood, including my jaw. The gravel road was smoother, the stones smaller, and the tree branches hung down around the path and nearly covered us. If the pain didn't diminish then, the familiar yet strange sights hypnotized me into believing that it had. But my head continued to throb with the measured insistence of a bass drum. And how could a toothache pass the calaboose, hear the songs of the prisoners, their blues and laughter, and not be changed? How could one or two or even a mouthful of angry tooth roots meet a wagon load of poor white trash children, endure their idiotic snobbery, and not feel less important? Behind the building, which housed the dentist's office, ran a small path used by servants and those tradespeople who catered to the butcher and Stamps' one restaurant. Mama and I followed that lane to the back stairs of Dentist Lincoln's office. The sun was bright and gave the day a hard reality as we climbed up the steps to the second floor. Mama knocked on the back door, and a young white girl opened it to show surprise at seeing us there. Mama said she wanted to see Dentist Lincoln and to tell him Annie was there. The girl closed the door firmly. Now the humiliation of hearing Mama describe herself as if she had no last name to the young white girl was equal to the physical pain. It seemed terribly unfair to have a toothache and a headache and have to bear at the same time the heavy burden of blackness. It was always possible that the teeth would quiet down and maybe drop out of their own accord. Mama said we would wait. We leaned in the harsh sunlight on the shaky railings of the dentist's back porch for over an hour. He opened the door and looked at Mama. "Well, Annie, what can I do for you?" He didn't see the towel around my jaw or notice my swollen face. Mama said, "Dentist Lincoln, it's my grandbaby here. She got two rotten teeth that's giving her a fit." She waited for him to acknowledge the truth of her statement. He made no comment, orally or facially. "She had this toothache pert near 4 days now. And today I said, 'Young lady, you going to the dentist.'" "Annie?" "Yes, sir, Dentist Lincoln." He was choosing words the way people hunt for shells. "Annie, you know I don't treat Negro, colored people. I know, Dentist Lincoln, but this here is just my little grandbaby, and she ain't gonna be no trouble to you." "Annie, everybody has a policy. In this world, you have to have a policy. Now, my policy is I don't treat colored people." The sun had baked the oil out of Mama's skin and melted the Vaseline in her hair. She shone greasily as she leaned out of the dentist's shadow. "Seemed like to me, Dentist Lincoln, you might look after her. She ain't nothing but a little mite. And seemed like maybe you owe me a favor or two." He reddened slightly. "Favor or no favor, the money has all been repaid to you, and that's the end of it. Sorry, Annie." He had his hand on the doorknob. "Sorry," his voice was a bit kinder on the second sorry, as if he really was. Mama said, "I wouldn't press on you like this for myself, but I can't take no, not for my grandbaby. When you come to borrow my money, you didn't have to beg. You asked me and I lent it. Now, it wasn't my policy. I ain't no money lender. But you stood to lose this building, and I tried to help you out." "It's been paid. And raising your voice won't make me change my mind. My policy," he let go of the door and stepped nearer Mama. The three of us were crowded on the small landing. "Annie, my policy is I'd rather stick my hand in a dog's mouth than in a nigger's." He had never once looked at me. He turned his back and went through the door into the cool beyond. Mama backed up inside herself for a few minutes. I forgot everything except her face, which was almost a new one to me. She leaned over and took the doorknob, and in her everyday soft voice, she said, "Sister, go on downstairs. Wait for me. I'll be there directly." Under the most common of circumstances, I knew it did no good to argue with Mama, so I walked down the steep stairs, afraid to look back and afraid not to do so. I turned as the door slammed and she was gone. Mama walked in that room as if she owned it. She shoved that silly nurse aside with one hand and strode into the dentist's office. He was sitting in his chair, sharpening his mean instruments and putting extra sting into his medicines. Her eyes were blazing like live coals and her arms had doubled themselves in length. He looked up at her just before she caught him by the collar of his white jacket. "Stand up when you see a lady, you contemptuous scoundrel." Her tongue had thinned, and the words rolled off, well enunciated, and sharp, like little claps of thunder. The dentist had no choice but to stand at ROTC attention. His head dropped after a minute, and his voice was humble. "Yes, ma'am, Mrs. Henderson." "You knave, do you think you acted like a gentleman, speaking to me that way in front of my granddaughter?" She didn't shake him, although she had the power. She simply held him upright. "No, ma'am, Mrs. Henderson." "No, ma'am, Mrs. Henderson, what?" Then she did give him the tiniest of shakes, but because of her strength, the action set his head and arms to shaking loose on the ends of his body. He stuttered, much worse than Uncle Willie. No, ma'am, Mrs. Henderson, I'm sorry." With just an edge of her disgust showing, Mama slung him back in his dentist's chair. "Sorry is as sorry does, and you about the sorriest dentist I ever laid my eyes on." She could afford to slip into the vernacular because she had such eloquent command of English. "I didn't ask you to apologize in front of Marguerite because I didn't want her to know my power. But I order you, now and herewith, leave stamps by sundown." "Mrs. Henderson, I can't get my equipment." He was shaking terribly now. "Now that brings me to my second order. You will never again practice dentistry, never. When you get settled in your next place, you will be a vegetarian, caring for dogs with the mange, cats with the cholera, and cows with the epizootic. Is that clear?" The saliva ran down his chin, and his eyes filled with tears. "Yes, ma'am, thank you for not killing me. Thank you, Mrs. Henderson." Mama pulled herself back from being 10 feet tall, with 8-foot arms, and said, "You're welcome for nothing, you varlet. I wouldn't waste a killing on the likes of you." On her way out, she waved her handkerchief at the nurse and turned her into a croquisack of chicken feed. Mama looked tired when she came down the stairs, but who wouldn't be tired if they had gone through what she had? She came close to me and adjusted the towel under my jaw. I had forgotten the toothache. I only knew that she made her hands gentle in order not to awaken the pain. She took my hand. Her voice never changed. "Come on, sister." I reckoned we were going home, where she would concoct a brew to eliminate the pain and maybe give me new teeth, too. New teeth that would grow overnight out of my gums. She led me toward the drugstore, which was in the opposite direction from the store. "I'm taking you to Dentist Baker in Texarkana." I was glad after all that I had bathed and put on mum and cashmere bouquet talcum powder. It was a wonderful surprise. My toothache had quieted to solemn pain. Mama had obliterated the evil white man, and we were going on a trip to Texarkana, just the two of us. On the Greyhound, she took an inside seat in the back, and I sat beside her. I was so proud of being her granddaughter, and sure that some of her magic must have come down to me. She asked if I was scared. I only shook my head and leaned over on her cool brown upper arm. There was no chance that a dentist, especially a Negro dentist, would dare hurt me then. Not with Mama there. The trip was uneventful, except that she put her arm around me, which was very unusual for Mama to do. The dentist showed me the medicine and the needle before he deadened my gums. But if he hadn't, I wouldn't have worried. Mama stood right behind him. Her arms were folded, and she checked on everything he did. The teeth were extracted, and she bought me an ice cream cone, from the side window of a drug counter. The trip back to Stamps was quiet, except that I had to spit into a very small empty snuff can, which she had gotten for me. And it was difficult, with the bus bumping and jerking on our country roads. At home, I was given a warm salt solution, and when I washed out my mouth, I showed Bailey the empty holes where the clotted blood sat like filling in a pie crust. He said I was quite brave, and that was my cue to reveal our confrontation with the Peckerwood dentist and Mama's incredible powers. I had to admit that I didn't hear the conversation, but what else could she have said than what I said she said? What else done? He agreed with my analysis in a lukewarm way, and I happily, after all I had been sick, flounced into the store. Mama was preparing our evening meal, and Uncle Willie leaned on the door sill. She gave her version. Dentist Lincoln got right uppity. He said he'd rather put his hand in a dog's mouth, and when I reminded him of the favor, he brushed it off like a piece of lint. Well, I sent Sister downstairs and I went inside. I had never been in his office before, but I found the door to where he takes out teeth, and him and the nurse was in there, thick as thieves. I just stood there till he caught sight of me. Crash, bang, the pot's on the stove. He jumped like he was sitting on a pin. He said, "Annie, I done told you I ain't gonna mess around in no nigger's mouth." And I said, "Somebody's got to do it then." He said, "Take her to Texarkana to the colored dentist." And that's when I said, "If you paid me my money, I could afford to take her." He said, "It's all been paid." I told him everything but the interest has been paid. He said, "'Twasn't no interest." I said, "'Tis now. I'll take $10 as payment in full." You know, Willie, it wasn't no right thing to do, 'cause I lent that money without thinking about it. He told that little snippety nurse of his'n to give me $10 and make me sign a paid-in-full receipt. She gave it to me, and I signed the papers, even though by rights he was paid up before. I figure he gonna be that kind of a nasty, he gonna have to pay for it. Mama and her son laughed and laughed over the white man's evilness and her retributive sin. I preferred, much preferred, my version. 25. Knowing Mama, I knew that I never knew Mama. Her African bush secretiveness and her suspiciousness had been compounded by slavery and confirmed by centuries of promises made and promises broken. We have a saying among Black Americans which describes Mama's caution. If you ask a Negro where he's been, he'll tell you where he's going. To understand this important information, it is necessary to know who uses this tactic and on whom it works. If an unaware person is told a part of the truth, it is imperative that the answer embody truth. He is satisfied that his query has been answered. If an aware person, one who himself uses the stratagem, is given an answer which is truthful but bears only slightly, if at all, on the question, he knows that the information he seeks is of a private nature and will not be handed to him willingly. Thus, direct denial, lying, and the revelation of personal affairs are avoided. Mama told us one day that she was taking us to California. She explained that we were growing up, that we needed to be with our parents, that Uncle Willie was, after all, crippled, and she was getting old. All true, and yet none of those truths satisfied our need for the truth. The store and the rooms in back became a going-away factory. Mama sat at the sewing machine all hours, making and remaking clothes for use in California. Neighbors brought out of their trunks pieces of material that had been packed away for decades in blankets of mothballs. I'm certain I was the only girl in California who went to school in watermarked moiré dresses and yellowed satin blouses, satin-backed crepe dresses, and crepe de chine underwear. Whatever the real reason, the truth for taking us to California, I shall always think it lay mostly in an incident in which Bailey had the leading part. Bailey had picked up the habit of imitating Claude Rains, Herbert Marshall, and George MacReady. I didn't think it at all strange that a 13-year-old boy in the unreconstructed southern town of Stamps spoke with an Englishy accent. His heroes included D'Artagnan and the Count of Monte Cristo, and he affected what he thought were their swashbuckling gallantries. On an afternoon, a few weeks before Mama revealed her plan to take us west, Bailey came into the store shaking. His little face was no longer black, but a dirty, colorless gray. As was our habit upon entering the store, he walked behind the candy counter and leaned on the cash register. Uncle Willie had sent him on an errand to White Folks Town, and he wanted an explanation for Bailey's tardiness. After a brief moment, our uncle could see that something was wrong, and feeling unable to cope, he called Mama from the kitchen. "What's the matter, Bailey Jr.?" He said nothing. I knew when I saw him that it would be useless to ask anything while he was in that state. It meant that he had seen or heard of something so ugly or frightening that he was paralyzed as a result. He explained when we were smaller that when things were very bad, his soul just crawled behind his heart and curled up and went to sleep. When it awoke, the fearful thing had gone away. Ever since we read The Fall of the House of Usher, we had made a pact that neither of us would allow the other to be buried without making absolutely positively sure, his favorite phrase, that the person was dead. I also had to swear that when his soul was sleeping, I would never try to wake it, for the shock might make it go to sleep forever. So I let him be, and after a while, Mama had to let him alone, too. I waited on customers and walked around him or leaned over him, and, as I suspected, he didn't respond. When the spell wore off, he asked Uncle Willie what colored people had done to white people in the first place. Uncle Willie, who never was one for explaining things because he took after Mama, said little except that colored people hadn't even bothered a hair on white folks' heads. Mama added that some people said that white folks had come over to Africa, she made it sound like a hidden valley on the moon, and stole the colored people and made them slaves, but nobody really believed it was true. No way to explain what happened blows and scores ago. But right now, they had the upper hand. Their time wasn't long, though. Didn't Moses lead the children of Israel out of the bloody hands of Pharaoh and into the promised land? Didn't the Lord protect the Hebrew children in the fiery furnace? And didn't my Lord deliver Daniel? We only had to wait on the Lord. Bailey said he saw a man, a colored man, whom nobody had delivered. He was dead. If the news hadn't been so important, we would have been visited with one of Mama's outbursts in prayer. Bailey was nearly blaspheming. He said the man was dead and rotten. Not stinking, but rotten. Mama ordered, "Jew, watch your tongue." Uncle Willie asked, "Who? Who was it?" Bailey was just tall enough to clear his face over the cash register. He said, "When I passed the calaboose, some men had just fished him out of the pond. He was wrapped in a sheet, all rolled up like a mummy. Then a white man walked over and pulled the sheet off. The man was on his back, but the white man stuck his foot under the sheet and rolled him over on the stomach. He turned to me. My, he had no color at all. He was bloated like a ball. We had had a running argument for months. Bailey said there was no such thing as colorlessness. And I argued that if there was color, there also had to be an opposite. And now he was admitting that it was possible. But I didn't feel good about my win. The colored men backed off, and I did too. But the white man stood there looking down and grinned. Uncle Willie, why do they hate us so much? Uncle Willie muttered, they don't really hate us. They don't know us. How can they hate us? They're mostly scared. Mama asked if Bailey had recognized the man, but he was caught in the happening and the event. Mr. Bubba told me I was too young to see something like that, and I ought to hightail it home, but I had to stay. Then the white man called us closer. He said, okay, you boys, stretch him out in the calaboose, and when the sheriff comes along, he'll notify his people. This here is one nigger nobody got to worry about no more. He ain't going nowhere else. Then the men picked up the corners of the sheet, but since nobody wanted to get close to the man, they held at the very ends, and he nearly rolled out on the ground. The white man called me to come and help, too. Mama exploded. Who was it? She made herself clear. Who was the white man? Bailey couldn't let go of the horror. I picked up a side of the sheet and walked right in the calaboose with the men. I walked in the calaboose carrying a rotten, dead Negro. His voice was anxious with shock. He was literally bug-eyed. The white man played like he was going to lock us all up in there. But Mr. Bubba said, oh, Mr. Jim, we didn't do it. We ain't done nothing wrong. Then the white man laughed and said, we boys couldn't take a joke, and opened the door. He breathed his relief. Whew. I was glad to get out of there. The calaboose and the prisoners screaming, they didn't want no dead nigger in there with them, that he'd stink up the place. They called the white man boss. They said, boss, surely we ain't done nothing bad enough for you to put another nigger in here with us, and a dead one at that. Then they laughed. They all laughed, like there was something funny. Bailey was talking so fast he forgot to stutter. He forgot to scratch his head and clean his fingernails with his teeth. He was away in a mystery, locked in the enigma that young Southern black boys start to unravel, from 7 years old to death. The humorless puzzle of inequality and hate. His experience raised the question of worth and values, of aggressive inferiority and aggressive arrogance. Could Uncle Willie, a black man, Southern, crippled moreover, hope to answer the questions both asked and unuttered? Would Mama, who knew the ways of the whites and the wiles of the blacks, try to answer her grandson, whose very life depended on his not truly understanding the enigma? Most assuredly not. They both responded characteristically. Uncle Willie said something like, he didn't know what the world was coming to, and Mama prayed, God rest his soul, poor man. I'm sure she began piecing together the details of our California trip that night. Our transportation was Mama's major concern for some weeks. She had arranged with a railroad employee to provide her with a pass in exchange for groceries. The pass allowed a reduction in her fare only, and even that had to be approved. So we were made to abide in a kind of limbo until white people we would never see, in offices we would never visit, signed and stamped and mailed the pass back to Mama. My fare had to be paid in ready cash. That sudden drain on the nickel-plated cash register lopsided our financial stability. Mama decided Bailey couldn't accompany us since we had to use the pass during a set time, but that he would follow within a month or so when outstanding bills were paid. Although our mother now lived in San Francisco, Mama must have felt it wiser to go first to Los Angeles, where our father was. She dictated letters to me, advising them both that we were on our way. And we were on our way, but unable to say when. Our clothes were washed, ironed, and packed. So, for an immobile time, we wore those things not good enough to glow under the California sun. Neighbors who understood the complications of travel said goodbye a million times. "Well, if I don't see you before your ticket comes through, Sister Henderson, have a good trip and hurry back home." A widowed friend of Mama's had agreed to look after, cook, wash, clean, and provide company for Uncle Willie, and after thousands of arrested departures, at last we left Stamps. My sorrow at leaving was confined to a gloom at separating from Bailey for a month. We had never been parted. The imagined loneliness of Uncle Willie, he put on a good face, though. At 35, he'd never been separated from his mother. And the loss of Louise, my first friend. I wouldn't miss Mrs. Flowers, for she had given me her secret word, which called forth a gin who was to serve me all my life. Books. 26. The intensity with which young people live demands that they blank out as often as possible. I didn't actually think about facing Mother until the last day of our journey. I was going to California, to oranges and sunshine and movie stars and earthquakes, and finally I realized, to Mother. My old guilt came back to me like a much-missed friend. I wondered if Mr. Freeman's name would be mentioned, or if I would be expected to say something about the situation myself. I certainly couldn't ask Mama, and Bailey was a zillion miles away. The agony of wonder made the fuzzy seats hard, soured the boiled eggs, and when I looked at Mama, she seemed too big and too black and very old-fashioned. Everything I saw shuttered against me, the little towns where nobody waved, and the other passengers in the train, with whom I had achieved an almost kinfolk relationship, disappeared into a common strangeness. I was as unprepared to meet my mother as a sinner is reluctant to meet his maker. And all too soon she stood before me, smaller than memory would have her, but more glorious than any recall. She wore a light tan suede suit, shoes to match, and a mannish hat with a feather in the band. And she patted my face with gloved hands. Except for the lipsticked mouth, white teeth, and shining black eyes, she might have just emerged from a dip in a beige bath. My picture of Mother and Mama embracing on the train platform has been darkly retained through the coating of the then embarrassment and the now maturity. Mother was a blithe chick, nuzzling around the large, solid, dark hen. The sounds they made had a rich inner harmony. Mama's deep, slow voice lay under my mother's rapid peeps and chirps like stones under rushing water. The younger woman kissed and laughed and rushed about, collecting our coats and getting our luggage carted off. She easily took care of the details that would have demanded half of a country person's day. I was struck again by the wonder of her, and for the length of my trance, the greedy uneasiness was held at bay. We moved into an apartment, and I slept on